I agree with you on that. Yes, I'm an endocrinologist here at Ohio State, and so I specialize in diabetes, hypertension, and lipid metabolism. We do see a lot of patients with type 1 diabetes, but we actually see more patients with type 2 diabetes. And the difference between those, traditionally it was thought to be age. They referred to it as juvenile or adult, but that's not true anymore. And it really never was, because we have young children with type 2. We have geriatric patients with new type 1. The key is, whichever kind you have, you're not making enough insulin for what your body needs. So the difference is that with the type 1, it's an absolute deficiency of insulin. If they don't start on insulin immediately, you know, that day they could possibly die. Whereas the person who has type 2 diabetes, they're making some insulin, but not enough for what their body needs. So we give them medications to try to better balance their ability to make insulin, how their body processes insulin, what we refer to as insulin resistance. And if we can get that back into balance with those medications, then we don't necessarily need insulin. I will caution you, though, that eventually everybody needs insulin. Hopefully they don't need it for 10, 20 years or more if we can really get them in balance with the medicines. Absolutely. You know, and it's very normal to be scared to go to the doctor and scared to hear what they're going to tell you. And, you know, the biggest risk factor for type 2 diabetes is actually a family history of diabetes. So quite often people come to us because a family member checked their sugar and it was high. So sometimes we really encourage our patients to reach out to family members and check them and help get them to doctors sooner. But the symptoms that really should get you to a doctor, and these are the symptoms that mean the sugar is really high and you're at risk for infections, you're at risk for something called diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, which can land you in the intensive care unit and people can actually die from it. Those symptoms are being thirsty all the time, frequent urination, this can be nighttime, daytime, or both, very tired, partially from getting up all night to urinate, and also being hungry all the time, eating a lot, not gaining weight from that hunger, and actually losing weight even though you're eating way more food than you should be eating. So any one of those symptoms alone may not be enough, but when you start to put the picture together, and certainly family members do this a lot over the holidays, they look at someone and they see that picture. But those are the things that should get you to come in and be checked, whether it's with your primary care or if you have a lot of those symptoms, and especially if you're losing weight already, maybe just going to urgent care and letting them check your sugar is really important. Now, why is it important to identify the sugar? Why is it important to control it and keep it under control? When your sugar is high, it's doing damage to basically every cell in your body. And we focus on the blood vessels, the heart, the kidneys, the eyes. So the high sugars put you at risk for heart attack, stroke, sudden cardiac death, vision loss, which can lead to blindness, also kidney disease, which can lead to kidney failure, but also damage to the blood vessels in your feet, so that you, if you get an infection in your foot, it can go bad very quickly and you end up with amputations, starting with the toe and then below the knee and then maybe even above the knee. The other thing we do tell people about, which sometimes kind of gets their attention, is we talk to the men about the risk of erectile dysfunction, because that can happen very early on if the sugars are uncontrolled. And if we don't get the sugars under control, it can be permanent. Normally, men don't develop erectile dysfunction until after age 50. But if you're getting diagnosed with your diabetes at age 30 and you don't have it under control, you can easily have complete erectile dysfunction by age 40 or even age 35. Diet and exercise are very interesting for prevention. Everybody thinks they have to change the world and, you know, lose the huge amounts of weight to prevent diabetes. But the data tells us that if you've been told you have pre-diabetes, if you lose just 15 pounds or maybe 10% of your body weight, 15% of your body weight, depending on how much you lose, that first 15 pounds has the most important role in slowing the progression to diabetes. So I always tell people, you know, sure, it's great to lose 50 or 100 pounds, but start with that first 15, because getting that first 15 pounds off and keeping it off has the most significant role in slowing the progression to the diabetes. Now, the truth is, what would be nice is to never get to the point of having prediabetes at all. And prediabetes means that your sugar is a little bit abnormal, but not abnormal enough to meet the criteria for diabetes. However, to go with that prediabetes, you usually have a slightly high cholesterol and high triglyceride, which means you're already starting to develop risk for heart attack and stroke to go with it. So the question becomes, how do you prevent the prediabetes? And the answer there is to look at your family. And if people in your family have diabetes, then you need to really be careful for the rest of your life to be as healthy as you can and as physically active as you can. So you don't necessarily need to be a size 2 supermodel, but you need to be a healthy weight. And you need to get there by eating healthy. And I cannot say enough how much you need physical activity. Physical activity keeps your body sensitive to insulin, so your body doesn't have to make as much insulin, and your pancreas doesn't have to work as hard, and it helps to slow down the progression to diabetes. So one way to look at it is, if there's diabetes in your family, if you stay as healthy as you can, you might still get the diabetes when you're 70 or 80 or 90 years old. But if you do those things to be healthy, you have control over when you get it, as opposed to it coming on at a very young age. The choice of the first medication that you get really depends on the clinical situation at the time. So if you recall, type 1 diabetes is an absolute deficiency of insulin, and those patients have to go straight on to insulin. The person with type 2 diabetes has a relative deficiency of insulin. So we do focus on using multiple medications, rarely just one, to try to get everything back into balance. It is important to note here that when you have type 2 diabetes, there's not a way to cure it. You could maybe get it into remission, but even if it goes into remission, you still want to take one or two medicines to keep it there. Back to the question of what happens when you're first diagnosed. If your sugars are so high that you've gotten to the point that you're losing weight, especially if you've lost unexpectedly 20 pounds, 50 pounds, 75 pounds, your body is what we call very catabolic. It's just burning up all the energy, and it needs insulin to get it back into a stable place. So the person who has a very high A1C, usually above 9 or 10%, and they've lost weight, we will typically start them on insulin at first. I would say also the person who ends up in the hospital with a very high sugar, maybe a little bit of the ketoacidosis or DKA, that person will start on insulin at first. But with our modern medicines, there's a chance that once we get your sugar stable, we can switch it to some of the other medicines, and you may not have to take the insulin, at least not for the first few years, maybe even 5 or 10 years, or maybe you only need just a small dose of insulin at bedtime to help make sure your medicines work. And the medicines that I'm referring to, many people know about metformin, which we've had for many, many, many years. But that's actually not our first-line therapy anymore. The first-line therapies are the medicines that are the once-a-week injections. We refer to them as GLP-1 medicines. And that's going to be things like dulaglutide, semaglutide, tirzepatide. And they are first-line therapy now to start with a once-a-week injection. And they often come in little devices to inject them so that you never even see the needle. You just put it against your skin and push the button. Even people who are scared of needles are usually able to use those devices. Then we also have another set of medicines that come as pills that complement those once-a-week injections in a way that we typically use both of them together. We start with one, and our next medicine is to add the other one. And this class of pills we refer to as SGLT2 inhibitors. And while the once-a-week injections are good for sugar, controlling weight, preventing heart attacks, these SGLT2 inhibitors are very good at protecting the kidneys and also improving heart failure. So the two medicines complement each other, and both of them do a very nice job of lowering the sugar. If you still need more medication after that, we might add metformin, we might add something like pioglitazone, we might even add a low dose of insulin at bedtime. But it's nothing like what it was many years ago, where if your sugar was that high, you just went on two insulins and that was it, and you didn't have any other options. We really do have options to combine these medicines together. And in general, these medicines are covered by insurance. Sometimes the insurance might ask you to do them in a different sequence than our guidelines do. But in the end, the insurance lets you get to these combinations of two or three medicines.